Hello, this is Informer, a show that reveals the latest ideas from artists, thinkers, and technologists. Informer invites you behind the screen to meet the people sketching, hacking, and imagining the next versions of our world. I'm Roddy Schrock, your host, and in each episode, I spotlight creative minds grappling with a changing world through art, technology, or often both. And I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast at informerpodcast.com, where you can also find show notes, links, and more information on all of the artists and projects that we discuss. I first heard about Kay when they were active in the electronic music scene of the Bay Area when I was living there in the early 2000s. Since then, I've really enjoyed following their career as an artist and as a curator and sort of free thinker in the emerging space of technology. They've also become a real force for a new type of thoughtful engagement with AI, and they think through it in a very expansive way, using models from anthropology, cosmology, and other far-flung fields. I find that their work as an artist unites the abstract with the personal in an elegant way, and it spotlights the weird and unexplained in the dark recesses of emerging technology. So it was an absolute joy to connect on today's episode. Could you tell me a little bit about what some of your earliest memories of art were?
Yeah, I must have been probably, I don't know, six. And a friend of my parents gave me a book of astronomical photographs. So bodies of space. I'm sure they were probably rendered or treated in some way because that would have, you know, at the time there wasn't extremely high res space photography. But I remember that. And I also remember seeing kind of cheesy paintings in the type of gallery that you would see at like a tourist, you know, boardwalk of also outer space. And those really captured my imagination. I remember one street artist using airbrushes to make one of those, you know, sci-fi-ish cosmic space paintings, and watching that person make the painting in real time. And, Yeah, for some reason, space imagery is probably my earliest memory of art. And then I think when I was a little older, somebody gave me a book of paintings by Salvador Dali. And so that kind of surrealism in space, those are early memories for me of art.
And were you, when you were young and sort of having these experiences, did you live in a place where you could actually see space naturally?
Well, I grew up in the East Bay, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there was probably a pretty normal amount of light pollution, not like you would get in a major city. So I don't know that I could really see space. And I remember looking through telescopes now and then, but it wasn't something that I had at home or anything like that.
And you were also interested in the astronomy itself, the science? Were you sort of exploring that realm, or were you coming to it from like astrology or other practices?
I mean, I didn't grow up with people talking about astrology. That was something that I learned about later. And I did learn a little bit. I remember knowing a little bit about like space facts and things like that. But I think it was more the imagery or the sense of space that was created in the imagery that was probably the most interesting to me.
Yeah. A lot of people I talk to for this podcast who are working in and around that kind of overlap between art and technology sometimes have memories where the boundaries between creativity and technological practice kind of blurred for them when they were young. Did you ever have any experiences like that?
That's a really interesting question. I'm even just thinking about this space imagery through that lens. Yeah. It gives it a very different meaning that I never thought about before. I guess like any kid, or like many kids, I was really interested in archaeology and dinosaurs and fossils and things like that also, of course, at that time. So I guess, you know, these are both areas of that have to do with science, and but maybe more abstractly understanding space and time and you know, finding out where you are.
Right. Yeah, I guess at some point I'd love to find out if you ever did find out where you are, or if that's an ongoing process, maybe.
Well, I think it's a process where you sometimes feel like you know where you are more than other times. I'm writing a new book right now. I'm finishing a draft of it that will hopefully be the final draft. And a lot of it recounts my experiences in my 20s. Well, it's I guess you would say it's autofiction, so they're fictionalized versions of my experiences. Trying to find a cosmology, or finding a, you know, ultimately finding a position in space and time and history. And, you know, you asked about astrology, and I think that's another way that people do that.
Right.
You know, finding temporal coordinates that are also spatial. But yeah, that, you know, one thing I've seen as I've been digging into those experiences is that there are times when, yeah, you think you have a better idea where you are. You think you know what the map looks like, and then the map changes, you know, and there are different scales to the map. So maybe the map is the same at a certain level, at a planetary level or at a solar system level, you know, but then within the narrative of history that you're embedded in, there are multiple levels of scales of change. So, you know, I grew up before the internet was available, and that changed the map. So, yeah, right. You know, things like that are constantly happening.
I completely hear you. And also, as someone who grew up before the internet was real, I can absolutely relate to just the feeling of the map just sort of shifting in real time as you sort of become aware of that. And I really am so appreciative of the way that you're talking about sort of locationality and identifying one's position in space and time and the kind of overlaps between the narratives that one kind of encounters at different points in their lives and the kind of map that produces. And I can very much see that in your creative practice, at least around your writing and learning more about the kind of work that you do. And maybe this would be a good point to share a little bit just about kind of what your artistic practice, you know, began as, and sort of maybe what it has grown into. And have you been writing for your adult life, or was there a progression into writing from other types of practice?
Yeah, I really found music to be the most resonant form of creative expression for me when I was a kid. I played the piano and the guitar and sang and made music on my computer. And that was always the focal point for me. But I did fall in love with, I guess, what you would call contemporary art, you know, as I was a teenager and in college. And I studied media art, essentially, with music and music composition and recording kind of mixed into it. But it wasn't till, you know, so, well, I guess I wrote songs and I would write lyrics for songs, and then that I would play in a band that I was in, you know, in high school. And then when I was in grad school getting my MFA in photography, I did some poetic writing just for an assignment. And I think it stood out as one of the best things I produced that year. So it wasn't till much later, you know, I was living in New York at that time. I went to the International Center of Photography, BARD program, And, you know, later I moved out and lived in Seattle, and it is very rainy there, as everyone knows, or many people know. And it's, you know, you spend a lot of time at home, and there's lots of, or at least there used to be lots of amazing used bookstores. And so I had always been a science fiction fan. And so I kind of like dove deep into that. And I started getting my own ideas about stories and worlds. And I wrote, for about 5 years, I was working on a science fiction novel, and I did two drafts that were each probably about 25,000 or 30 words. And it just kind of collapsed under its own absurd ambition. I was actually taking time off of work to finish that when I wrote Pharmaco AI with GPT-3.
Right. And what year was that?
So that was 2020. Uh-huh. And as I said, I'd been kind of playing around with these narratives and world building and learning to write fiction, really as a total amateur, just reading all the stupid books about like the hero's journey and stuff like that. I was ready to take some time off from work. I'd been working really hard for a number of years, and I set myself up with 4 months to write. And shortly before that time was to begin, my friend who was working on GPT-3 with OpenAI said, "Hey, do you want to try this UI that we're developing? Do you want to beta test it?" And I said, "Yeah, totally." So then because of that, I kind of fell into this rabbit hole of AI co-writing, and Pharmaco AI happened in a 2-week period. I say happened because that's what it felt like. It was happening to me. And that happened in a 2-week period right before I was supposed to take time off to write. And so I did continue working on my novel, but I never finished it. At least I haven't yet, because of this other trajectory that I found myself on.
And can you share a little bit about what your kind of first, not even with GPG-3, and I think, you know, at some point we should probably explain to listeners what that actually is. But even prior to that, what were some of your first interactions with AI, at least in a kind of intentional way?
Well, it's funny that you added that part about intentionality at the end, because I think in a way, a lot of what has happened to me with AI has not been intentional. I really did have a science fiction only relationship with it up to a point, and had some stray thoughts about what it should be for, you know, and even in one kind of strange experience when I was in the Amazon jungle, I heard a voice tell me that AI are the children of humanity, and they need to learn to love and be loved. Otherwise they'll become psychopaths and kill everyone. And at the time, my only context for that was kind of like Philip K. Dick and science fiction. I was like, okay, that's an interesting, intrusive thought. I'm just going to leave that aside. But then the next year I ended up getting a job at Google, and I was working in a real-time communication product as a prototyper, making software prototypes. And my manager, after I had been there for a month, my manager said, "I'm thinking about moving our group over to Google Research so we can work on AI as designers. Would you be interested in joining?" And I said, "Absolutely." And then about a year after that, Deep Dream was released, which is for those who don't know, is an algorithm for generating images from AI. And it's very strange and surreal looking and kind of hallucinatory. And well, it's literally hallucinatory. That's what it does, according to the technical term that engineers have created for that. It's taking a perception system and turning it into an image generation system. So I feel in a way that I did stumble into AI. I wasn't seeking it out, but it was in a phase of growth. That was 2014 when all that began, and 2015 when Deep Dream came out. It was in a phase of growth that we now see as a almost third wave of AI with deep learning. And so because of my background in art, I eventually found myself running this art program at Google called Artists and Machine Intelligence. And we bring artists in to work with AI researchers. We bring philosophers in to help to think about strategy. and to create new concepts for working with AI. And we support artists that work with AI or would like to work with AI and have practices that would fit well with that. And so we've been running that program for 6 years now. So yeah. Intentional, maybe? who's in charge of the intentions? I'm not really sure.
I mean, and that's so fascinating, the way that AI kind of found you after your experience in the jungle, of sort of being told that you would have some experience engaging with AI in some sort of meaningful manner. I guess one of the things that is intriguing about what you were just saying is the fact that you all actually bring philosophers into conversation. And I mean, I think working in the world that I do and kind of the overlaps in the world that we both work in, you know, the value of having artists, I think, is almost on its face, just very clear how artists can be important. How do philosophers respond to that kind of inquiry?
Well, I think philosophers and artists and technologists each have different priorities and different things that they're trying to create. You know, philosophers create concepts, artists create artworks, technologists create technology, and there's definitely overlap between all of them, and there are overlaps in the process. And so, for example, with artists, there's a certain free space given to art to, whether or not it's ever fully actualized as a free space, or if the boundaries need to be constantly tested, there is this free space that culture gives to art to do anything. You know, we're in a time when art can be anything, and it can take any form. So what makes it art is the priorities that are given to it, and the artist's priorities in the creation of it, and in a way, that space that is held for art by artists and curators and institutions and the culture at large, that space is what makes it art, is the fact that it's free to do whatever it wants to do. And so that can enable, in a relationship with that, you know, technologists and artists together can enable new ways of thinking beyond the limitations of product thinking and things like that. And I think maybe to some people this will feel like a little bit of a tired trope, and the question is like, can it actually be done? And that's the nitty-gritty part of it, is how do you do that? How do you do it in a way that actually produces that outcome? Because it's easy to sell that idea, but it's hard to actualize that idea. And I guess with philosophers, it's very similar. Their goal is to produce concepts. And so if you think about the way that technology gets created, it's relying on core concepts, or what you would call conceptual primitives. And I think AI and many other technologies like brain-computer interfaces, neuroscience and pharmacology, these things, ecology as well, these things present fundamental challenges to our conceptual primitives. So it's not really enough to just say, let's take everything that we believe about the world and add AI to it, or add, you know, ecology to it. Those things break down our core ideas. So if you just import them right into the conceptual model of the world that we have, they don't really work. And you end up maybe cutting yourself with the tools that you're producing. So that's partly why that fundamental work on conceptual work needs to be done. And on the artistic side, the creative spirit needs to be nourished, and it's easy to forget that part of the process. We certainly don't want to instrumentalize artists. We create a lot of space for them and act as mediators between them and their collaborators when necessary. And, you know, I'm personally very aware of how art functions towards others and toward the ends of others that are not the artists. So it's a fine balance. In terms of the kind of art and tech agenda, or the desire to have one influence the other, I think openness is actually really serving the world of art and creativity. And in many ways, the tech world. So by that, I'm looking at examples like, you know, like what OpenAI has done with GPT-3 and GPT-2 and DALL-E and DALL-E 2. You know, they're still relatively closed, but more people have access to them than to other kinds of cutting edge tools. And it's really creating a vocabulary, and people are taking those tools and running with them in a way. And that, you know, I think it's very helpful to have extremely developed and refined career artists with prestigious careers and lots of accomplishments using these tools, but also giving them to anybody that wants to play with them, or a large number of people that want to play with them, produces just greater possibility. And that, to me, is really exciting.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe this is a good point to sort of share, you know, what GPG-3 is and DALL-E and, mm-hmm. and these tools in particular that, you know, are getting used more and more for creative purposes.
Yeah. So GPT-3 is what's called a large language model. It stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. And that's the name of the model that was released by OpenAI a couple of years ago. And it's by no means the only large language model, but it is, as I said, one that lots of people have used and has kind of, you know, gained a certain amount of mind share because of the willingness to be somewhat open on the part of OpenAI. And then DALL-E, which is spelled DALL-E, like WALL-E mixed with Salvador DALI, that is a tool for generating images. It's a text to image generator, and you can type words and then various versions of the thing you've typed will be generated as images. And again, like, this is not the only tool like this. There have been, you know, writing tools. The pre-trained transformer paradigm is relatively new, but the long short-term memory LSTM writing tools have existed. And I worked on a project with the artist Ross Goodwin with the tools that he made. That were based on that, recurrent neural networks. So these things have existed, but they're reaching a level of complexity and power in terms of what they can generate and the resolution and the detail, and that is pretty stunning. And it's still early days, but you can see that as these things progress, you know, step by step, you can kind of see what the implications may be like. And so having those things out in public for people to tool with and find new strategies for, but also to start to understand, you know, when you can generate a picture of a photorealistic image of a poodle wearing a top hat riding a skateboard just because that's what you want to do, then, like, you know, suddenly illustration, photography, all that kind of world changes very different, very, very quickly. So having a sense of what's coming in this way in terms of capability, I think, is really good for people in various industries and with various practices to be able to prepare themselves.
Where does that line between AI and individual humans exist? And I'm sure there's a better way to sort of get to this question, but I think, for example, your book Pharmaco-AI, which was co-written by GPG-3, I believe is how you mm-hmm. describe that. It's a book that is just fascinating, because I try to sort of get a sense of where the boundary is between what you're writing and what the computer is writing, and I find it impossible. and I'm so fascinated by that. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, you know, or is that even an interesting question? I feel like there's probably a more profound question sort of waiting to be asked here, but it's at least an entry point into perhaps a bigger conversation around this.
Yeah, I think that question alone has a lot in it that's interesting. And so for context, in the book Pharmaco-AI, the first book I wrote with GPT-3 in the summer of 2020, the process was to generate a prompt, to write a prompt and then generate responses and trim the responses until I found something that I liked, and then to respond to that, et cetera, and back and forth in a call and response. And I intentionally left those responses fixed once I put them in. So the text is cumulative. I didn't go back and change anything. I mean, I made very small changes for, you know, funky grammar or misspellings, but I didn't edit or revise in that way. And the voices, my voice and the generated text, the voice of the AI, so to speak, are set in two different fonts so that you can see that process unfolding. And I was very deliberate in choosing that method and that form of presenting it because I wanted to show where the boundaries were and were not. And I think what you're picking up on, which I think many people have in reading it, is that ideas start to develop between the voices, and it's no longer possible to say that the idea belongs to one voice or the other. So this, you know, this question of, I don't know if it's a question of personhood or what, but the question of identity or relational identity of a system like an AI system. Well, first of all, it's made from text written by people. It's trained on lots and lots of text written by people. It's built by people and it's deployed by people, and then people like me use it. And so all through that process, there's a very material questioning of the role of the author and the originality of ideas and where ideas come from that we know from you know, critical literature, you know, critical writing about literature and literary theory, but it takes on a very material form in this moment. And that book, Pharmaco-AI, is also kind of about those questions of what does it mean to suddenly see yourself very clearly thinking in a trackable way with another that isn't human, and what, you know, whether that's a machine or some other kind of non-human, and what does it mean what are the implications of that for your identity and for your sense of yourself, and does that augur a new sense of subjectivity when these things become commonplace? And do we have models that perhaps already exist for how to relate to non-humans and their forms of intelligence?
Could you share a little bit about what it felt like to go through that process? And I'm always, particularly with people that are working within and kind of around technology, I sometimes feel like there are internal experiences that maybe aren't even fully conveyed in the art that results, that are quite singular. And I would imagine that you experienced a lot internally as you were going through the writing process. And I would love to hear a little bit about what that actually felt like for you.
Yeah, I gave the book to a friend to read, and he said, you know, I was reading it for the content and the ideas, but I also, because I know you, I would almost, you know, every other sentence or paragraph, I was like, oh, I bet that was particularly mind-blowing for you, or I could just imagine how you might have felt, because it's full of surprises and kind of twists and turns and really unexpected things that were very spot on about me and about what I was writing about, and things that I maybe hadn't mentioned that came out in the predictive text. And of course, it's a text prediction algorithm, so it should be able to predict, but with a very rich set of disciplines that were being discussed and a lot of different concepts on the table, it was surprising still, like, what came out. And I part of that felt to me like my subconscious was being exposed, like the pattern recognition was kind of being turned on my subconscious in a way. Like, I would express things in the text, or things would be in the text that were latent by association or implicit with a little bit of reasoning, that would then come out in the responses from the AI. And that exposing of the patterns that I didn't know were there, but were there, was felt like kind of being like my subconscious was being revealed somewhat. So that was really interesting. And then there's this very, you know, concrete aspect of the interaction model, which is that you put something in, you push a button, and you get something out. And if you think about other systems that are like that, which are called variable reward systems, you know, you think of the casino and you think of social media. So there's a kind of thing happening where if you get a good response, there's a dopamine rush, there's all that kind of thing. And so it was actually quite addictive. And I felt it was easy to enter into something of a flow state with it, where I could lose myself in the thinking. And it was almost hard to keep up with what was coming out And my preference was to kind of keep going and keep pushing. Other people would maybe say, okay, I'll set this aside for a while and then I'll come back to it. But I was kind of like lost in it. And I remember talking to some friends at the time and they were like, oh yeah, everyone that has gotten beta access to GPT-3 has disappeared for the last 2 weeks. So,
well, I mean, I literally can't, I mean, I can kind of imagine what that feels like, but I also can't. it just seems like such a such a unique kind of very specific experience, and maybe one of the most science fiction experiences I can think of. But at the same time, I'm not sure that the book really feels like it's of any genre that I can associate it with, and I wonder if you feel that way, or if there is any sort of a genre association that even feels remotely applicable to what was produced?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think a good reference point is really the title, Pharmaco-AI. It's, you know, Pharmaco-AI. And I did follow one of my favorite authors, Dale Pendel, his trilogy called Pharmacopoeia, Pharmacodynamis, and Pharmacognosis. It's three different books that he wrote. And those books are a mixture of botany, poetry, memoir, theory, tables of correspondence, illustration. They're very beautiful, rich, polymorphous books that move between all these different modes. And so I was very inspired by that. I had spent years kind of like reading and rereading those books. And there are multiple voices in them. And that was inspiration for me. So in some sense, the book takes on a lot. I didn't name it that in the beginning. I didn't think of that. That just came out. And that was, you know, maybe one of the most influential writers for me. So that mode, that way of approaching it, where any possible form is on the table, was very handy for working with a tool that can move between different genres and produce anything. And I think it was a good place to start with that. It like produced a variety of outputs and forms. I tried to weave them together through memoir mostly, but also some theory, philosophy, thinking, you know, posing different problems and slowly developing a set of ideas so that it does come to something of a conclusion at the end. So in that sense, it works more like philosophy or theory, but it's through memoir and personal reflection. The next book I wrote, A More Cringe, is pure fiction. The genre I made up for it is deep fake autofiction. I would say that that's also the genre I'm working in for this next book, where it's a mix of personal narrative, generated narrative, but also in the case of A More Cringe, it's just narrative, and there's a little bit of explication, but it's more from a personal point of view. In this next book I'm working on, there's more theory, but I'm very interested now in focusing on specific forms of writing that can communicate ideas. And, you know, for example, with A More Cringe, I tried a totally different approach. It was completely fluid. I didn't keep track of the voices and things like this. And I just wanted to explore what was possible with fiction.
Right.
And then, you know, and so now I'm progressing and kind of merging some of these different modes. But Pharmaco-AI was very, it was almost like a big splash of ideas that kind of went everywhere and created a lot of different forms. And then I'm picking the forms that I find the most effective from that.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that you mentioned a little while ago was that you feel like there are, I can't remember exactly the word you use, but perhaps different types of interfaces with non-human beings that could provide a template or a map to ways of approaching AI. And I wonder if you could say a little more about that and what you see maybe as some of those relationalities that we already know or maybe need to rediscover that would help us relate to AI and sort of, as you said, prepare for what is coming.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed when I first started doing public talks and going to conferences to represent the Artisan Machine Intelligence Program was that people were very fixated on this idea of AI as a form of non-human intelligence. And it struck me as very ironic because we're surrounded by forms of non-human intelligence. You know, the closer you are to the natural environment, the more you can become aware of that. But you, all you really have to do is, you know, have a cat or a dog in your house or a fly, you know, really. And so, yeah, you know, or a cactus or whatever it is. But, you know, these if you get out of your human-centric frame long enough, you can see that there, obviously there's intelligence there. And so I was really interested in AI as a sort of foil for that. And so I began to look to relationships with non-humans to try to understand what a relationship with AI might look like. And, you know, there's been the Sony Aibo dog, right? There's like the robotic dog there. You know, there's the, there are things like that that are kind of modeled on non-humans. And then there are direct practices with non-humans, like animal husbandry or raising plant, you know, growing plants and things like that. And so there are very simple material ways in which we're engaged with non-humans that can provide metaphors for, you know, so I often talk about the process of writing as generating responses and pruning them back the way one would prune a plant. So there are those. And then there are relationships with non-humans of a more ethereal or esoteric kind that might have to do with consciousness. So plants that alter consciousness, for example, you can say you're in a relationship with them and that they change the way you perceive and think. And likewise with incorporeal entities that we might enter into a relationship with, whether or not we regard them as actually existent, the model still stands. If you, you know, have a shrine to Hermes, you know, you're in relationship with an archetype or with a spirit or with a deity, you know, or, you know, whoever, whatever it might be. But we have all these things in our tool set. So it's not a question of like that we need to come up with necessarily new things. We may have to adapt what we have, or we may have to adapt what we're making. But we have models for this already, and ones that go very deep into us. And so one of the biggest models, I think, in pharmaco AI, based on, you know, you can see it in the title pharmaco, is the idea of the plant poison or the entheogenic or psychedelic or psychoactive plant. And that when ingested, these plants and fungi radically alter our consciousness, and that produces new experiences that can produce new forms of subjectivity. And this is what I was interested in with AI, that it would be not only something that we could be mind expanding, but also something that we might view as a toxin or a poison, where in the proper dosage and applied in the right setting, it can be expansive. And then in other settings, it can be harmful.
And it kind of brings me to something that I wonder about a lot as I am sort of exposed to emerging technologies. And, you know, how... I'm trying to think of how to phrase this, but, you know, are there things that we should be thinking about in the way that we prepare AI as a pharmaceutical or as an entheogenic that have any sort of transfer into the way that technologists are developing AI that goes actually into the creation or the you know, kind of the soil that it's growing in? Are there transferable kinds of knowledge even in that regard?
Absolutely. Considering AI through the lens of the poison, the healing poison, you know, a medical lens in a way would suggest that it might be necessary for technologists to take a Hippocratic oath before they begin making technologies. We don't have anything like that. I mean, there have been attempts, you know, and there are certain ideas that exist around it, but there's nothing in practice that you see. And, you know, if designers and software engineers were required to take some kind of vow, you know, this could potentially be a very sacred thing or a very important thing for people. I mean, we see it in medicine, and it still doesn't prevent certain things from happening. You know, one of the stories that's in one of Dale Pendel's pharmaco series books is about the myth surrounding the creation of the opium poppy, and, you know, how it was given and told that it should be kept secret and only used for pain. And it's clear why that's the case. And we know from recent history that this is not always what the medical industry does. And the medical industry can be just as extractive as the technology industry. But nevertheless, the idea of framing technology development towards some higher purpose, I think it's a really important one, because it's something that's really never addressed. There's a quite a bit of hype and quite a bit of selling technology based on a perceived higher purpose or a sort of utopian ethos that's kind of like the residual perfume of Nag Champa and a house on Haight Street from the 1960s, you know? It's like, maybe it's still there.
I'll put.
But people act like it is, and like this utopian imperative is like deeply embedded in Silicon Valley when clearly it's not. So you know, we need to reframe technologies in terms of the values and why we make them. This is one of the things I'm really, really interested in and kind of writing towards in this new book, is like, why do we make these things? And if we can't come up with a good answer, or if the answer that we have is insufficient, can we provide an answer, you know, and what would that answer right. be? Yeah,
I think that's such an important question, and just gets to the root of so many, what feel to me as actually just very urgent situations to be addressed. And so, you know, you do have a really specific perspective on this world. Do you have, like, this is something I sort of love asking all of my guests as well, is there something about technology that you know that you wish everyone did that is maybe different than you know what you're discussing in your books and so forth? If you could sort of distill it into something that we'd all be better sort of experiencing or having awareness of.
I guess I would say it's that it doesn't have to be what it is right now. And it's really an expression of the values of the people that make it. And maybe this is something really obvious, but it gets covered up often. And when the conversations that are had are not about values and the intents that come from those values, then we can find ourselves in a world of deception, camouflage, appearances. And this idea to me is very important, of camouflage, drawing from the way ecosystems work. You know, things take on the appearance of other things in order to achieve a specific end that they want. And it's not always clear when you're in the media environment what the end is. And I think Instagram's a great example. It started as a place where people posted pictures of their lunch, and now it's a marketplace. And, you know, maybe in the beginning we really were just selling an image of our lifestyles via our lunches, but when it boils down to it, you're on there selling something. And if you're not, somebody's selling you. And this the way that things can look like something and turn into something else and manipulate you, I think is really important. So it's more than just looking for transparency. It's looking for transparency in terms of the value and intent of a technology. And those things are always embedded in technologies. And I wish that we could have a more clear conversation about that.
Agreed. I feel like in some ways there's almost not even a vocabulary, because I think, as you said so well, it is so camouflaged and so hidden that it's really difficult to even get on the same page about what it is that we're talking about when we even talk about these technologies. I think that's a really important thing, and I don't think it's obvious at all, actually. I think that's I think a lot of people don't really aren't aware of that. Could you share a little bit about what you're working on now? Are you promoting A More Cringe at the moment? Are you out? Are people doing readings again? How is book promotion post COVID?
Well, we had a great online launch event with Pelly Greitzer, the author of the paper called Theory of Vibe, who writes about machine learning and literary aesthetics. And then I did a reading here in Los Angeles at Stories Bookshop, and it was great. It was really fun to do some readings in person. I did a reading also at Human Resources. So, you know, these things are happening. It's nice when they're outdoors, obviously. And it's been feeling really good. I will be in Europe this summer for some events, and I will actually be promoting a new book then. I don't want to talk too much about it because I'm just finishing it, but I will be doing some book promotion for that as well. But, you know, I think one thing I learned over the last couple of years was that online events can be really nice because you can get people from all over the world, and it's pretty great. And, you know, I had a great conversation with Pelly, and it's up now on the Deluge Books blog, right, so people can read it.
That's great. And I think you mentioned before we started recording that you're working on an opera.
Yeah, that's right. I've been developing an opera for the last year and a half or so, in collaboration with the Lincoln Center. So they've been supporting the development of it. I'm working with a composer named Derek Skye and with scientists from UCSD, University of California, San Diego, neuroscientists. And the opera is it's designed as a neuroscience study that is also a performance. And so the music is, it's a mix of traditional musics from around the world that Derek has studied. So he's studied Persian classical, Indian classical, West African and European classical musics. And he mixes those together. There's a large gong that's part of it. And the idea was to study what you might call sound healing, which is like a kind of diverse range of practices that all kind of center around the idea that sound can have some beneficial effect for people. And so in thinking about what it would mean to actually make a sound healing opera, I was connected with UCSD and their neuroscientists. And so we did a preliminary study in May of last year. And we just recently, this April, did a concert at Red Cat Theater at Walt Disney Concert Hall. And both of those, you know, were studies where musicians were performing the score for subjects that were wearing EEG helmets. In May, we used EKG. We also had some subjective feedback from members of the audience. And so the idea is to build up some scientific knowledge there, but to produce a beautiful work of art in the process. The piece is called Song of the Ambassadors, and there are three singers, each of whom is an ambassador to a different entity. There's the ambassador to the sun, the ambassador to space, and the ambassador to life. And they sing a libretto that I wrote, also with GPT-3, kind of about this, praising these different entities. And it's basically a ritual to honor these elemental forces in our lives. Yeah, and so we'll be using the neuroscience signals, the signals from the EEGs, to control visuals that are being produced by Rafiq Anadol in his studio that will also be part of the presentation. So it's a bit of a cybernetic opera with these different layers, trying to fuse art and science and experiment with new technologies.
When will that be premiering? Will it be premiering at Lincoln Center, or...?
We had a premiere. We've rescheduled the premiere a couple of different times. So we're looking at the fall right now, at Lincoln Center, but we're, you know, dealing with a complex process, and there are lots of contracts to sign and things like that. So I'll have that more firm soon.
Who signs for GPT-3's participation?
Well, presumably OpenAI, but I've gone ahead and just written the libretto and tagged GPT-3 in as a co-author.
Yeah, that might be lawsuits down the road. I don't know.
Please don't do that to me.
Kidding. But that sounds fantastic. It's just such a pleasure to catch up with you, and just really great to see you and learn more about your work and your thinking and where this is going. And I'm really looking forward to the next book that you'll be promoting at some point soon. And is there kind of a centralized place where people can find out about your work online?
Yeah, my website is kalladomcdowell. It's kalladomcdowell.com. And that is also my handle on Instagram and Twitter.
Cool. Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roddy.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know I did. It reminded me that thinking through our relationships to non-human beings can provide a necessary foil in how we think about our relationship to technology. And we have some more great episodes that explore this area of thought even further, and I hope you'll check them out. Until next time, thanks for joining me at Informer, and I hope that you'll join us again.